Why do bad things happen to good people? It seems to be an age-old question. It challenges our conventional wisdom, especially when our first introduction to Job is that he is blameless and upright and fears God. And that doesn't mean he's afraid, but he reverences God and turns away from evil. In fact, that is one of the purposes of the book of Job, is to try and answer the problem of evil. There are three primary purposes: to try and answer the problem of evil, to refute false religious concepts like righteousness automatically brings prosperity and unrighteousness automatically brings destruction. There are plenty of folks that we would see as unrighteous who seem to be making out like bandits in the world. Well, maybe they are making out like bandits in the world. And the third major emphasis in the book of Job is to prove that piety, religious piety, can be practiced and can be rewarding even without hope of reward. That we can continue to be righteous and practice that religious piety with God even without the hope that we're going to gain that reward. In fact, it is that kind of religious piety that in the face of destruction, in the face of bad things happening when we are good, that ultimately can help us find not only meaning for our lives, but meaning for others and in others as well. So, we come to the book of Job, and we come to this first section, which in your book is entitled Job's Innocent Affliction. Job's Innocent Affliction. And this evening we'll be dealing predominantly with the prose section, the early prose section of the book of Job. So I want you to think just briefly for a moment, and you might want to jot down somewhere. And you cannot include your family, your friends, your house, or your salvation. Okay? What are your three most treasured possessions? You cannot include your family, your friends, your house, or your salvation. What are your three most treasured possessions? Being an American in this country would be one. Health. Okay, the Bible, the Word of God. Others. If David were here, all he'd do is grin because we've got a basketball signed by the 1993 Tar Heel National Championship team signed before they won it. So for him, that would be... He has said if the house ever catches on fire, that's the first thing he's grabbing. But your three most treasured possessions. And then imagine that when you go home tonight, what you prize the most is gone. Completely gone. Maybe we got a Red Dawn. I know you've seen the movie. Patrick Swayze, Red Dawn. You have to have it. It's a war movie. Kind of.
Red Dawn.
Yes, Red Dawn. Invasion by Russians and other forces that takes away the freedoms of Americans. Or you go home and all of a sudden there's on the news that they're going to confiscate all the Bibles in the country and you can't have one and you can't read one. Or worse than the MRI needed on your knee, you go home and suddenly your health is taken away completely. Or any number of other things. If you think about that, your three most treasured possessions in your life, and what if you went home tonight and they were gone? How would you feel? What would you feel? What would it do to you? How would you react to that? How would you react to that?
I might have to start to feel like
Okay, one of the obvious reactions might be, other than anger and disbelief, might be, okay, what did I do to deserve this? Have you ever had events happen in your life and that was your question? What in the world did I do to deserve this? I've heard that question over and over again, especially in hospitals. In hospital settings, and be with a family that's in an ICU situation, it's a very devastating situation, and they want to know what they did, and especially a parent if something's happened to a child. What did I do to deserve this? I must have done something wrong to bring this on my child or to bring this on this person. Why did it happen? Or maybe, okay, God, where are you? I thought you were supposed to be good. I serve you. I go to church. I tithe. I do this. I do that. I pray. Is that not enough? Why did this happen? Generally, we'd phrase it, why did you let this happen? But there are those out there that would say, why did you make it happen? Why did you cause it to happen? Highly Calvinistic folks. It's got to be God's will. God must have caused it. Have you ever had those situations and you wondered yourself, where is God? Maybe you haven't ever experienced times of devastation or uncertainty, and you pray and you don't seem to hear, and you've never said, okay, God, where are you? Are you even listening? It is a human condition, and these are all actually fairly normal human reactions. And this is part of what is raised by the book of Job, are these kinds of questions. Of course, in the book of Job, we'll talk next time, but in the book of Job, Job eventually gets to the point where he starts cursing. But he dare not. He comes close to really letting God hold it, but he's not quite there yet. So what does he do? He curses the day he was born. He curses his lifestyle, all that kind of stuff. But in a roundabout way, what's he really doing? He's not really questioning so much himself. He's questioning God. And he's questioning, in some senses, the goodness of God. Most of what the average person knows about Job is actually found in the first two chapters. Even most church folks, is found in the first two chapters. What do you know about Job? We've talked about it a little bit. What do you know about Job? He was a righteous man and what? Lost everything. Everything was taken away. And then after that, when he still didn't curse God, after he's lost all of his family except his wife, after he's lost all of his possessions, after he's lost all of his money, all of his land, his houses, that wasn't enough. Then what happens? Yeah, physical illness and infirmity, covered with sores and all kinds of other things. And that's most of what we know. And when we think of Job, as we said a couple of weeks ago, the first word that comes to mind starts with a P. The patience of Job. And yet, was Job really all that patient? We think of him as such. And early on, he sits there and he refuses to curse God. But as we read through the book of Job, and I would encourage you to do that, he kind of loses his patience more than once. With God, with his friends, with his wife, with himself. And the deeper question perhaps that we find here is, why serve God? Why do we serve God? Because that question is raised early in the book. How is that question raised in the book of Job? Who raises the question about Job serving God?
Satan.
The Satan.
Is he serving God because of what God's done for him, or is he serving God because of his faithfulness?
Okay, that's right, Paige. Is he serving God? The Satan says, is he serving you because of everything you've given him and all the stuff you've done for him and how wondrous you've been to him? Or does he serve you because of who you are and he really loves you and all that kind of stuff? And the Satan says, I think he serves you because, hey, look, everything he does, he's got the Midas touch. fixes your mufflers and all. No, he's got the Midas touch. Everything he touches turns to gold. Everything is great. But if you take it away, he'll curse you. Now, the prologue and the epilogue are the oldest parts of the book. They're in prose and they're the oldest parts of the book. Predominantly because if you read your textbook, they use what word for God? Most of the time. Yahweh. That's right, Paige. Yahweh. That old, old word, Yahweh. And actually many of the oldest sections of the Old Testament, in particular the oldest written section of the book of Genesis, chapters 2 through 11, use that word for God, Yahweh. Or it uses Elohim. We're not going to get into all the stuff. You can read in a textbook about how Jehovah is actually a hybrid word. You know, we use the word Jehovah. It never really occurs in the Hebrew text. It's a hybrid between the consonants of the Hebrew, Yahweh, and the vowels for Adonai and Elohim, to keep people from saying the sacred name of God and profaning it. But Yahweh occurs predominantly in older Hebrew texts. So those portions are old. The poetry sections are not as old. And they use more personal names for God, or less personal names for God, excuse me. And they use such words as El, Eloah, and El Shaddai, which are later names that are used for God. It's also in this book and in the beginning that we are introduced to not just Job and not just God, but also the heavenly court, and in particular, one leader in the heavenly court other than God, and that is Hasatan, the Satan, the adversary. At this point, he is still part of the heavenly court. He still goes back and forth, to and fro on the earth, kind of functioning more like the heavenly, as Cartledge says, but as I've said for years, more like a heavenly district attorney.
Well, why does the book say that they're talking about a different Satan than the one that we're always referred to?
The book says that because actually it's most of the places in the Hebrew text that the word Satan is used is with the definite article, the Satan or the adversary. In the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures in 250 B.C., those scholars chose the Greek word Diabolos rather than the Satan, and it had become a proper name by that point in time. In some of the non-canonical books that show up around 300 or 400 B.C. and on down, such as the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs and the books of 1st and 2nd Esdras and others, there is a move toward defining the Satan or the devil as one that was always in opposition to God, who even fell early. And then as Christians later come to understand that there are forces other than just good in the world, those tend to be personified in that individual, the devil or Satan, and it's then that it becomes a proper name. It's actually incorrect to make it a proper name in the Hebrew Scriptures. The non-biblical texts and the New Testament texts actually say more about the devil or Satan as an evil person or force than does the Hebrew text. In fact, in most places in the Hebrew text, in almost all places in the Hebrew text, I think all but three, the word Satan occurs with the definite article, the Satan. So given that, but when we as Christians read back into and understand in our theologies generally that the devil was in the serpent in the Garden of Eden and tempted the man and the woman in the Garden of Eden. In Hebrew thought, early Hebrew thought especially, there was not that concept. And when that was written around 1000 B.C., there was not that concept. The writer, the serpent is a cunning creature that was part of God's creation, that was jealous over the relationship that the man and the woman had with God, and so saw an opportunity when God says, I'm putting this tree in here, now you're going to have to choose, contrary to what Calvin said, but now you're going to have to choose, who saw an opportunity to try and put a wedge between them and God so that the serpent could be liked again. So, you know, for the Hebrew writers and for the early Israelites, there was no idea that the devil had that kind of power and authority, nor was there any idea that the devil might be present in tempting Adam and Eve. Now, Jesus in Luke 10 says, you know, and if you read it in context, the 70 have come back and they're excited and they say, hey, we even spoke to demons and cast them out of folks. Boy, how about that? And Jesus, when he says, well, I saw the devil fall from heaven like a bolt of lightning. Of course, he doesn't say when he saw that happen. You know, and we tend to read, oh, well, that must have been before Adam and Eve. But if Job was on the earth and the Satan is doing that kind of stuff and still part of the heavenly court, then he wouldn't have been the same figure as that.
Well, I understand that. I think that the devil has always been around and always will be, as long as God allows him to be.
Right.
We can roam anywhere he wants to. But this book, that book right there specifically states that this is not the same Satan.
Actually, it's not. What he means is it's not the same concept of the devil or understanding of the devil in Job or even in Hebrew scripture as it is in later non-biblical scripture and the New Testament. That's what he actually means. And he gets that quote straight from Sam Ballantyne, and Ballantyne's a little more clear on it in his commentary on the book of Job. Is that, you know, it is a completely different understanding. Yes, he was. It may be this, and eventually it is the same being. It's just at the time of Job he hadn't been kicked out yet, and it's later that happens. He becomes too overzealous as the DA and gets to liking his job too much and decides he wants more power than he's got. But what Ballantyne says is and if you look at the Hebrew text and the way that it's portrayed in most of the Hebrew text, there isn't it is the same being, it's just there's a difference in what he did early and then when he tried to do other things and got kicked out much later. I understand what you're saying there, and I do. Cartledge comes close to saying it exactly the way you did, but what he means, and if you read Ballantyne's commentary, it is the same being, it's just functioning differently at different points in history, just like we function differently at different points in our own lives doing things, and that it's a different idea about whether it was the devil, the same devil we think of as the harbinger of evil way back when, or if that happened later. So it is the same being, it's just a matter of different time and a different function. So this story then takes place between heaven and the land of Uz. Probably somewhere east or southeast of Israel. Actually, east or southeast of Israel would put it somewhere around where they think the Garden of Eden might have been in that particular part of the world. And it's actually, and I agree with Ballantyne, that the location of Uz as being east or southeast of Israel has significance because it does draw parallels between this righteous person who had this good relationship with God and Adam and Eve who started out with a good relationship with God and had everything. They had paradise. Well, Job seems to have everything. Job has paradise with his family, with his money, with everything going well for him. But unlike Adam and Eve, who sin, and they lose because of their sin, Job's problems don't seem to have anything at all to do with sin. Or with his sin whatsoever. It's not the kind of person who has sinned and continues to sin, but rather he is blameless, as we've said. He's upright. He's a man who fears God, who turns away from evil. You would think nothing should go wrong for him. He has paradise. And yet he loses that paradise. But even in doing so, he's got a great deal of integrity. And his loyalty and integrity have been rewarded, and they will continue to be rewarded, but they are sorely tested. Which raises the question sometimes, is integrity always enough? Once again, the answer would kind of seem to be, well, no, it doesn't necessarily protect you. So we come here then to the first test. The first test in chapter 1, verses 6 and following, which begins in the meeting of the heavenly council, the heavenly court, and which begins with the Satan saying that Job, that God's pride in Job is misplaced. If you take away what he's got, he'll curse you. If his fortunes change, he will curse you. One day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and the Satan also came among them, and the Lord said to him, "Where have you come from?" And he answered the Lord, "From going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to the Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." And then he says, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Now, he doesn't, once again, when we use the word fear here, we're not talking about scared. He says, does Job reverence God for nothing? And does he do it just out of the goodness of his heart? And what he's saying is, no. He's doing it because of everything you've given to him. You've given him children. You've given him property. You've given him money. Destroy it, and you'll find what he's really made of. And so in a single night, Job loses fortune, fame, animals, and most devastating, his children. In one night, he loses it all. And he wasn't even in Las Vegas. Yes, Maxie.
Seeing that when I guess that right now is the point for me, with the children, and then he comes back and says that, and I say to Wesley,
now, how does he become that way when he doesn't have his children? Yeah. And you know, that is a major, major question. How does he come through it when he's lost? I mean, you can replace job, you can replace money, you can replace houses, you can replace cars, you can replace animals, you know. But how do you replace the children? And that probably seems to be the most unfair stroke of all, is the loss of his children. Now here he's physically lost them. But you know, sometimes we just as certainly seem to lose them, and not physically, but emotionally and spiritually. We lose. And how do you get there? How do you come back? All of this happening simultaneously would also have had Job thinking, well, God had to have something to do with it. And his reaction is interesting. Job arose, he tore his robe, he shaved his head, and fell down on the ground, and in his grief prayed. That's what it means when he says that he worshipped. He fell down on the ground, and he prayed to God. And in that prayer, he even says, "Blessed be the name of the Lord. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away." Maybe you wondered where that statement came from. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Well, it comes from Job's experience. And he blesses God. But it's interesting that Job recognizes you can't take it with you. When you go, you can't take it with you. He says, "Naked I was when I came in the world, and I'll go out the same way." But even in that, Job finds a way and a means of blessing God. which says something about Job's loyalty and Job's integrity, I think. But that doesn't necessarily help us when we face those situations.
Yeah.
And that is one of the major questions, Maxie. How do we get to that point? That's a hard thing, to get to that point. But integrity doesn't protect us from disaster. Loyalty doesn't necessarily protect us from disaster. And yet in the middle of that, the text, I think it's key to look in verse 22, and in all of this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. He said, God had to have something to do with it, and I don't understand what God has to do with it. And this is, I think, one of those situations, too, where Job is one who lacks understanding, and he is not afraid to admit, I don't know. I don't have a clue. I'm sure God's in here somewhere, but I don't have a clue where or why. And he really, in some senses, what Job does is just opens himself completely and throws himself on his face, on the mercy of God, and hopes it doesn't get worse. He hopes that somewhere along the line it doesn't get worse. And sometimes that's the only thing we can do. All this stuff comes and it piles on and it piles on and it piles on, and we try and figure out, well, here's an angle to get out of this, and here's an angle to get here, and here's an angle to get there, and then it don't work. Sometimes I think we have to get to the point to where in the middle of everything with all the hopelessness, we just have to completely open ourselves and say, okay, I don't understand. I might get angry. I might get mad. I might, there's a difference in anger and mad. My granddaddy used to say that dogs get mad and people get angry, but sometimes we foam at the mouth too. I might wonder and raise questions, where are you, or perhaps even, are you? But in the middle of all of that, I'm still going to maintain this sense of, I'm naked to you, there's nothing to hide. Help me to understand. And that's what Job is crying for here. And he doesn't charge God with wrong. He's pleading for God to help him to understand. And then things get worse. The Satan comes back for another meeting with God at the beginning of chapter 2. And God looks and says, you were wrong. I told you that Job wouldn't do that. You were wrong. He is an icon of faithfulness and obedient. And doesn't that impress you? And Satan says, no. Tell you what, Job's still unscathed. If you take away his health, you've taken his family, all he's got left is, as Francis said, his health. All he's got left is his health, but he's still alive. He's still got health. He can still walk around and run and he can jump rope. But take that away from him, then he's got nothing. And he'll curse you. And so God told him, you can do anything you want to other than kill him. And so Job is attacked with sores and diseases. In fact, if you really pay attention to the text as you read through this, it says in verse 7, Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and inflicted loathsome sores on Job from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he was so bad he even sat among the ashes and he took a broken pot and would try and scrape all those sores and wounds and all the stuff out of them. And when his friends show up in verses 11 and following, they don't even recognize him. In fact, the text in the Hebrew indicates that his breath is so loathsome, they don't even want to, they want to get upwind from him, not downwind. And they don't recognize him. And he suffers, sitting on the family garbage heap. And finally, his wife can't stand it any longer either. We think about Job all the time, but she went through this stuff with him. And she shows up. And she says, he's gone through all of this. She sees the man that she loves in a condition worse than death, sores that bred worms and crusted over, and broke open again. If you look in chapter 7, verse 5, it says that. She has suffered the loss of the children and everything else as well. His flesh is wasting away, chapter 16, verse 8. And the text in chapter 30, verse 30, he says his bones are burning with pain. And in her hurt and her anger, she says, well, why don't you just get it all over with? Just go ahead and curse God and die. Chapter 2, verse 9. Do you still persist in your integrity? Curse God and get it over with. Curse God and die. And Job's answer is interesting. Something we don't like to think about. You speak as any foolish woman would speak. Shall we get the good at the hand of God and not receive the bad? Should we only expect good? Should we be protected from bad simply because we think God ought to give us nothing but good? What makes us any different in this world than anyone else? I mean, if all we ever got was the good, then why wouldn't anybody serve God, right? And Job says, if I get good from God, but the pain comes, should I not also take the pain? If God is good enough to bless me and cares enough about me with good, if the pain comes, should I expect any less? And of course, the ultimate example, if we fast forward a few millennia, the ultimate example is in Jesus. God did bring the pain, but God took the pain upon Himself. But Job's answer is really interesting. If we get the good, should we not also get the bad? And he remains loyal throughout the whole thing. The interesting thing here is when his wife says that you should curse God, the word most of the time in the Hebrew is translated barak, or barak is usually translated bless. But here it is translated as curse. Ballantyne writes that blessing God and dying doesn't make much sense unless Job's wife is being sarcastic. Because what's Job just done? He's fallen down on his face and he's blessed God. And she said, well, bless God? Yeah. Nah. Just go ahead and curse him and die. In either case, Job refuses to cause offense to God. What do you think about that? What do you think about how Job reacts?
Well, at one point, he truly believes God. And he worships Him.
Yeah.
Despite everything that happened.
In spite of everything that happened, you're right. He truly believed God, he believed in God, and he worshiped Him. But Paige was sitting there just shaking her head, too. That's a strong faith. That's a faith that we don't often see what we hope to have. And maybe we see it from some folks.
But he had all the stuff like everybody else, but he didn't worship it. He still worshiped God.
And I think that is a key in the book of Job, is in spite of all of this, the things didn't become items of worship.
No, I'm with Mother. The things are things. I sit and think of, for how long we waited for Addison, and then to take that away.
As long as you waited for Addison and then something happens. As long as Abraham waited to have Isaac and then God says, now go out here and put him to death.
Well, if you look at it, starts with the tree in the Garden of Eden, and God, between God and the devil. God knew when He put that tree there that one of them was going to pick fruit off of it. Because He told them not to.
Free choice.
He knew that Job wasn't going to turn his back on Him regardless of what happened, as long as he was still living, just to try to prove the point of the devil. The devil ain't no telling how long he's been infuriated. God still got hope for him.
There's no telling. Yeah, you're right. There's no telling how long the devil's infuriated. God and other folks.
I think Job was just being long called, knowing that the term of life on me, he's very sort of firm. He leaves his faith with that. He knows his children take care of him. And the life of man is nothing compared to what eternity is.
And he does recognize that the ancient idea though here is when Job's thinking about eternity, he's not thinking about a nice pleasant garden. As you know, at the very most, it would be the concept of Sheol, where you know, this shadowy existence forever, that part of you that's immortal, which was neither a good nor a bad thing. It was just kind of, this is how it is. In fact, the text, it's interesting, the text says that he often worried that his children might accidentally curse God or do something to offend God anyway, and he constantly prayed for them that they not offend God. Because he wasn't sure how God was going to react to all of that. He was afraid it was going to be, he was afraid in some senses that the reaction was going to be, okay, punishment because you did something wicked, and that's the mode out of which his friends operate and his wife operated. And then all of a sudden, that gets flip-flopped. And Job, who's righteous, gets hit hard. And that throws everything into a turmoil. And you would expect him not only to raise questions to God, but you would expect him to curse God, maybe. And yet here in the middle of all of this, he still doesn't. He sits in the ashes and he does ask some serious questions. But even in that, seeking those answers and that trust, he doesn't curse God. It's a very hard thing not to do.
We can understand to a point. But I cannot, by the way, said some believe that this was the first book of the Bible to be written, and it crossed my mind as to, okay, what about an adult unbeliever? And you're trying to witness it, and if this is the first book that they, if this is the first thing they read,
it'd be tough. That was the first thing read. It is an ancient. The prose sections are very ancient. There are some who now some of the rabbis said that they were written by Moses. The prose sections were written by Moses. Some tried to say that they were even earlier. Actually, the Song of Deborah is some of the oldest written material in the entire Bible, over in the Book of Judges. But that would be a hard thing if that's, you know, the ancient and that story. But there are also similar stories in Egyptian teaching and Babylonian teaching, etc., but they take a slightly different tack. And in those, in some of those, the person raises those questions to God and lashes out at God instead of the way that Job did. But it raises questions too about what can we expect from God in this life. Something that was also in your book. You know, what can we expect from God? Does God bring evil or allow evil? Job was blameless and evil came on him. Did God bring the evil on him or allow the evil? Well, according to the story, God allowed it. The Calvinists would say God brought it. Everything happens for a reason and God causes it. That's Calvinist theology. Everything happens for a reason and God is the cause of everything good and bad that happens. Some say God allows the world to work and is there to help us through the bad if we remain loyal and maintain our integrity. That God builds certain things into the system, that God can but doesn't always just reach out and stop things or make things happen in the world, but we reap the consequences of pushing the natural laws that God builds into the world sometimes. But that God is there, and that Job recognized that in the middle of all of that, that God has some things in place, and in the middle of all of that, he still understood that God was there to help him through the bad if he remained loyal to God. That sense of integrity. Did you read the story about Tony Cartlidge and his wife and their daughter Bethany that was killed? And that kind of sets the tone for them. I mean, their daughter, young daughter Bethany, was killed. And yet in the middle of all of that, they didn't blame God. He was killed by a drunk driver. And they didn't blame God for it. It was hard. I remember, I didn't know Tony well, but I knew of Tony and some things in North Carolina with him. And I remember when they were going through that and how difficult a time that it was for them. But he didn't blame God for it. He didn't say, oh, that was God's will. And God, you know, but what they found through all of that was that God was there in spite of what happened, and the drunk driver, you know, went outside the norms, killed their daughter. But what he found was that God was there to help them through the situation, as terrible as it was, but that God didn't cause the situation. And it's a big difference in a Calvinist approach and a free will. And if God gives us free will, then God is free to do whatever as well. But we need to not seek trite explanations, but to listen, to pray, and to recognize that God can deal with our questions. We're the ones that have the difficulties dealing with our questions most of the time. God can deal with them. So we have to be willing to ask those questions. Among the themes that we find raised here too are the providence of God and God's freedom, and whether or not God can be limited to our theological understandings. J.B. Phillips, your God is too small, where he argues that we try and put God in different boxes. You've got the Santa Claus God and the policeman God and, you know, all those kinds of things. Or Mr. Beaver's quote from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when he's talking about Aslan, the lion who is the Christ figure. And he says at one point, oh, he is not a tame lion. It's a recognition that God is not a tame God if he's truly God. We try to tame him, and that's what Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar try to do. They try to put God in the boxes, and they also try to put Job into a box as to what's happened and how he ought to react. Although, and we'll talk more about their questions later, but although it is interesting to note that they sit in the ashes with their friend as he mourns. Before they ever say anything, they come and sit in the ashes with their friend for 7 days and seven nights while he mourns. I wonder what was going through their minds. And it also would raise the question, when did someone just give you their simple presence rather than try and explain things? Rather than trying to tell you what you ought to do with your pain. Rather than trying to explain your pain. They just sat there and gave their presence. Sometimes the gift of silent presence is the best thing we can give. Why do we generally try and say something, though, instead of sitting there and giving our silent presence? It's expected. People expect us to say something. Yeah. And who's uncomfortable in the silence? Yeah. We're, that's right, Paige, because we're uncomfortable with the silence. So we feel like we need to say something. And yet his friends, even though they have plenty to say, later on, his friends initially come and simply give Job their presence and their silence. And they share the silence. They wait for Job to take the next step. But as we've said, the book of Job also raises questions. Why worship God? And this is some of the questions that were at the end of your lesson, too. Why worship God? Do we do so with the idea of a quid pro quo system? We do this for God, and so we ought to get this out of it. God blesses the righteous and curses the wicked. Be righteous and you'll get good. Actually, you mentioned we're believers. The prosperity gospel of many today is just that quid pro quo system. Yeah. Shuler, Joel Osteen, and so many others. Do this, and God, you'll get what you deserve. God will give you. I only want what's coming to me, as the child says. I just want what's coming to me. Or people who talk about God put a wall of protection. I expect God to put a wall of protection around me. Why? Because I'm serving God. Keep anything bad out. Some of us believe or practice a kind of thing where, you know, we want the, it's kind of like Heavenopoly. So the get out of jail free card, we want the get into heaven free card. I don't know if there's ever such a game or not. I just kind of made that up. But it kind of came to my mind. Or fire insurance. Why do we worship God? Is it because of those things, or do we truly worship God because of the integrity and the attitude and belief we have that is consistent and faithful in God? Tony Cartledge does write in the book, to have integrity, that word tam, which also means wholeness. The Hebrew word also means wholeness. To have that integrity or that wholeness means to persist in the attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors that make us whole, consistent, and faithful. Faithful in life, in church, and before God. And that's what eventually we find Job has. And that's what gets Job through, is that sense of wholeness. The attitudes, the beliefs, and the behaviors that make him whole and keep him consistent. Even when he wants to scream at God. Because I guarantee you he wanted to scream at God. Because when he starts cursing himself and cursing the day he was born, he really wants to scream at God. Into the fire. We find ourselves very often in the fire. The key is to get out of the ashes into something that's whole and complete. And that's what I hope we will find ways to do as we work through Job, who certainly had things at least equal to what we experience, if not more so, in many ways. And I know I've kind of prattled along here, and I appreciate y'all's input. Any thoughts or questions that you all might want to share before we end for this evening, and next time we'll move on to chapter 2. Yes, George. Yes. Right, Frankel, Man Search for Meaning, yeah. Concentration camps, all of that. And Elie Wiesel talking about the Dark Knight. Right. Yeah. Those are both very. Elie Wiesel, who writes about the darkness of the concentration camps, etc., and Viktor Frankl doing the same thing, Frankl, in that kind of situation, and where there seems to be hopelessness, and yet the recognition that God is there even in the hopelessness. God doesn't cause it, but God is there even when it happens. And the tough thing is to turn and grasp instead of turning the other way. Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you. Next time, next Sunday night, we will be looking at number 2, Job's questioning lament. After sitting there for 7 days and 7 nights and being so faithful and so nice, suddenly Job starts asking questions. we do get to those points where we might have been afraid before, but we can get to the point where we start asking the questions. And I think it's important not only to ask the questions, but to note the ways in which we ask them and the expectations that we have when we do so. And may you find that whatever comes your way this week, whether that will be good or whether that will be very trying and very devastating, that any time we go into the fire and we turn and look for God, God can help us to come out of the ashes. But we have to go through the ashes for that new birth and that rebirth to happen. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.